Welcome back to Rockstock Channel. It is Monday, May 6th, and we have Keith Coughlin, the Managing Director of European Metals Holdings, back on Rockstock Channel. I think the last time you were here was during our ASX Lithium Rocks conference last September, Keith. European Metals Holdings has a project in the Czech Republic that they own 49% of. It's a single project company. That's the entire of the value of European Metals Holdings, which is listed on the ASX, ticker symbol EMH, and also on AIM, same ticker EMH. And it's also listed on the US OTC, has more than one listing, but one of the ones you could look at is EMHLF. I think about you more in ASX terms, but you shared with us some research out of your brokers in London, WH Ireland, and Liberum, who have target prices anywhere between, I think, 4 and 6 times higher than the current valuation. We'll flash those up here, but if any of you listening to this interview are interested in receiving that research, please email rockstockchannel@rkequity.com and we can get that to you. Reminder, you know, if you like and appreciate this video, please comment, like, and subscribe. European Metals Holdings has a Twitter handle, somewhat active, @CzechLithium. Keith, you're not super active on that, so I think you guys should just kind of visit that. And if you want to follow Rodney and me, I'm @LithiumIonBull, and Rodney is @RodneyHooper13. As often, I'm going to say, you know, 5 minutes or so words of some kind of background, you know, to frame the story. And then Rodney is going to go into, some more detailed questions. I want to thank, you know, the more than dozen of you shareholders in European Metals Holdings who did email us a lot of your questions. We're going to get to as many of those as we can. But first, I'd like to say that, you own 49% of the project, which is not unusual. Joint ventures are very common in the lithium industry. And one example, I think, you know, it's kind of like Lithium Americas and Ganfeng, you know, in Argentina. Yeah, but there are many others like West Farmers and SQM, you know, in Kidman. I'll also say Chez, as a new entrant, real prospective entrant into the lithium industry, it's a huge utility, in one of the top 10 utilities in all of Europe, with I think some 20 or 25 or even 30 billion euro market value. But they're entering the lithium business. Like West Farmers is not in lithium, but they're entering, you know, Koch Industries, Exxon, Sibanye-Stillwater, you know, Chinese companies like Zijin and Huayou, and even Rio Tinto, you know, the Portuguese oil company, Galp, Schlumberger, Codelco, you know, Lithium Power, even GM with LAC. So I'm just, the lithium industry needs well-capitalized partners. We started working together, Keith, right after Battery Day, Tesla's Battery Day in September 2020. We had followed your story. We're going to put up a stock chart here. You know, we knew you before then, in around 2015, 2016. We didn't like fully understand, you know, the story then, and your share structure didn't have Chez in it, you know, in those early days. But you've been around for a long time as a project. This is the largest hard rock project in Europe. You could talk about those details a bit, but there have been a lot of discoveries made. The scoreboard has grown, as we've said, from like 50 to 150 in the past 2 years. But if you go back 6 or 7 years ago, you know, there weren't that many, and you were among those that were there. But you know, a number of projects have advanced, you know, or had higher market caps than yours in Europe. You know, there's a comparator, the very different project, but you know, Vulcan Energy Resources has, you know, today a 600 million market cap. You have an 80 million market cap. We've always thought your project, which has been labeled strategic, and we could talk about that from a critical minerals, you know, point of view in Europe, you know, that there's some valuation discrepancy there. Your project is a mica deposit. It's not spodumene. And the head grade is like 0.4%. When people are familiar with spodumene, you think about 1% plus as being some magic number. And that's relevant for spodumene. But I'll remind viewers here that, Thacker Pass, a sediment deposit, which reports in PPM, actually, if you put it into, spodumene equivalent terms, is also, in that 0.4 range. And lepidolite, which is come onto the scene as a significant lithium source out of China, is lower grade than that. So it does have high recoveries. You can talk about that. But we have, over the past 3 years, introduced you to a number of companies in China and outside China who have examined, the project technically, and there's no problem, in processing this. The geopolitical winds have been, shifting, sometimes is China possible or not possible? I'd like to address that question with you, because BYD made a major announcement in December about building a big plant in Hungary. CATL has in 2022 announced a 7 billion euro investment also in Hungary. And both those companies have their own lithium sources in other geographies. So, Geely owns Volvo, Volkswagen has a partnership with Goshen. So the China bugaboo, which is a big problem kind of like in the US and Canada, is less so, we think, in Europe. So that's just a question, for later. I think that's, a bit of an initial intro. Like we've consulted with, Garrett Fuehling, who used to work at Rockwood and Albemarle, and he's always identified your project as, the most likely in Europe. Europe, for all its talk, still doesn't have too many, lithium projects. Keliber is owned by Sibanye now. So that's been, advancing, and AMG is looking to ramp up in Germany hydroxide from their Brazilian spodumene, but besides that, there's not much else. A lot of talk, and that's kind of like the lead-in. Introduce yourself, Keith. Remind people of your history, background, how long you've been involved with the project, and then Rodney will dig in with some of his questions, as well as the ones that shareholders gave to us.
Sure, Howard. Well, thank you for that introduction. Hi to you and to Rodney. It has been a while, as you say. So we acquired this project just over 10 years ago now, 2014, as a historic underground tin mine with a very interesting lithium resource. Not that it was in modern day JORC category at that point, but we have been at this for 10 years now. You talk about the process and the comfort in the process. We have completed a scoping study, 2 PFSs and a PFS update on the project, and we're obviously deep into the DFS now. We're very comfortable with the process. We're very comfortable with the production of battery-grade lithium chemical. The market probably isn't as comfortable as we are, but I think it's getting close. And as you say, there are a number of examples globally now of production of battery-grade lithium chemical from things other than spodumene and brine. So, we're relatively comfortable with that, and, I'll get the market more so as we go. But Rodney, nice to see you again. Over to you.
Thanks, Keith. Good to see you. So, naturally, a lot of the questions from shareholders was around the DFS and the delay linked to the new chemical site. Can you give any sort of updated guidance on a definitive timeline for the release of that study?
I think we're probably a few weeks to a month away from being able to give the market a date on the completion of the definitive feasibility study. Our chief consultants have been working on this for the last few months in order to be able to just tell us how much work has to be done to complete the DFS. And it's only on the processing plant. Everything else about the DFS is completed, and it is, you know, relative to this new site, if you like, there's no difference in the mining side. It's only, it only changes from, when the concentrate arrives at the Dukla site. And obviously, you know, there are a few changes from then on, but as we said in the announcement, the, we believe that the changes will be beneficial to the project, both from a commercial point of view in terms of OPEX and CAPEX, but also from a timing point of view, because even though the, this particular change has delayed the delivery of the DFS, as we've said, we believe it will speed up the overall process because it, it will abbreviate the permitting scenario. And that is, as we're seeing more and more, that is the main thing that we need to get right. That's the mediating factor from a timeline perspective, particularly in Europe.
Okay, well, that's good because it sort of addresses one of the questions I had, which was the impact of moving to the new site on the permitting process and the timeline.
So yeah, well, they're two separate questions, but they lead to the same thing. And, you know, we, Ches made a publicly available statement in country about this, and they obviously, you know a great deal more about this than European Metals does. You know, they really run this part of the process for the project. But, you know, they're very clear that moving the processing plant to Pünnerhof will speed up the permitting process. There is significant support from the regional government, from the local government. I believe there was even a quote from the local mayor with regards to this. And that's a, you know, that is a significant factor in the delivery of the project. So even though it slows up the delivery of the DFS, permitting timeline is shortened, and therefore the time to construction, the time to production is also shortened. We'll know more about wrapping some dates around those timelines once we're able to talk about the finish date for the DFS.
And Keith, Ches was the original owner of the site. So how does that impact your arrangement in terms of costing, or how do you sort of effectively offset that contribution by them?
So yes, Ches is the owner of the Pünnerhof site. There is still an existing operating power plant at this site, and it was the scene of a much larger power generation facility, you know, that was closed down recently. Ches are developing this site, which is far bigger than those two functions and far bigger than we will need as well, developing this site for an overall industrial complex. The gigafactory that was announced by Ches and the Czech government must be nearly 2 years ago now. It was slated for this site. They haven't made a recent public statement about that, but I believe this is still the favoured site for a Czech gigafactory. There is more than enough room for us to build a lithium processing facility bigger than we had envisaged at Dukla, if that's where we end up. But there's a sufficient ground for us to build that, and for Ches to still build a gigafactory in conjunction with the Czech government and a third party, a technical party, a cathode maker or a battery maker.
Okay, that's great, because that answers one of the questions I don't need to ask anymore in terms of what can happen on the site.
Yeah, look, it's a big site, and that's, you know, that is one of the great advantages, you know, moving from Dukla. We were always a little tight at Dukla, and with limited room for expansion. We'll still retain some facilities at Dukla, you know, the rope conveyor, bringing the concentrate from the portal down to where the lithium processing plant was going to be will remain. But instead of it delivering it into the processing plant, it'll deliver it to a loading facility where it'll be loaded onto existing rail for a 55, 56 kilometre rail journey to the new site. So one of the advantages of that is we took we bought the Dukla site was comprised of three separate properties. We bought one of those outright, we being Geomet, the project company, and we took options over the other two. We clearly don't need as much space there now, and we're just going through the process of working out which of those blocks we will keep and which we won't. If it goes the way that we don't keep the block that we bought outright, you know, there's a significant amount of money that would come back to the project company as part of that. With the new site, it's envisaged that we won't be acquiring that site, but we'd rather be leasing our space.
And Keith, so originally, you know, there was going to be the, you know, restacking the waste back into the mine site. What's the plan now at the new, from the new chemical site?
That's still the case. Is about, I think the number's about 35%, Rodney, of the, that 35% of the tails will still be used for backfill. So that'll go on those empty carriages back to Dukla, and it'll be returned back to the portal via the return of the rope conveyor that's bringing, you know, the material down from the mount. So there's a little bit of additional handling, but as I say, those rail cars are returning to Dukla anyway, and the rope conveyor's returning to the portal site anyway. So it's a, you know, it's a minimal increase in cost there.
And then someone has asked about whether, you know, the JV or the project is applied for CRMA strategic project status.
Yes, absolutely. We are well into that process. We've been in that process for some considerable time. I think it was late last calendar year that we first became formally involved in that process. There was an announcement from the EU two weeks ago, I guess now, outlining a timeline for the CRMA and what they need to do. It's a little disappointing. It's a little longer than we had hoped. But it is, you know, it's becoming more definitive. These things, you know, do take time, particularly in the EU. There's a lot of red tape that has to be jumped through, but we are well and truly in that formal process. But becoming a formally recognized strategic project under the CRMA will be very important for the project. You know, the CRMA itself talks about additional funding being made to these sort of projects, but also a abbreviated or a definitive permitting timeline, which is important because, you know, you can draw a line in the sand. We have a great deal of confidence that Cenovex will receive strategic project status for a number of reasons, but certainly not the least of which is the fact that the project has already received strategic project status under another of the EU's initiatives, which is the Just Transition Fund that we announced to the market, I don't know, a year ago, a little more than a year ago.
And Keith, will the new chemical site keep the Just Transition Fund support?
Yeah, there's no, specifically to the JTF, the Just Transition Fund, there's no impact at all with regards to moving the processing facility. The Just Transition Fund has been targeted for mining, infrastructure, mining and ore transport down to the loading station. So there's no impact at all on the JTF.
And the EBRD financing, there were some key recommendations that they had linked to financing. How is the JV performing against those recommendations?
So the key points to EBRD's terms, if you like, on becoming shareholders, and I must say very supportive shareholders of European Metals, firstly was the re-domiciliation of European Metals to Australia, which we made an announcement about perhaps a week ago. That's well underway and be concluded very soon. But we also agreed to adopt the ESG standards and sustainability and governance standards that the EBRD adhere to. But that was an easy thing for us to agree to because we were already doing it. We were already committed to doing it. So we make regular reports to the EBRD on those particular points, and you know, we are ticking all of those boxes. That's important for us, not just, you know, because of the relationship we have with the EBRD, but the the expansion of where we see that relationship going forward, not just with the EBRD, but with their close ally, the EIB, with regards to, you know, funding project when we get to that stage a little down the track.
So relative to the first feasibility, we're likely to see, like all projects, higher CapEx and OpEx. In the new release, is the intention to secure some kind of an offtake with a prepay or some additional initiatives for government loans or grants to help offset these increases?
So when you say relative to the first feasibility, you're talking about the preliminary feasibility study?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, definitely, you know, unfortunately, the way the world is, increases in CapEx and OpEx, you know, those numbers are 3 years old, in some cases, a little more than 3 years old now. So, and we've obviously had some significant inflation in the world and specifically in Europe in those 3 years. Happily, that inflation has abated, and I note that Czech Republic has the second lowest inflation rate in Europe right now. So that's, at least it's going back in the right direction, but those numbers will still be higher. In terms of offtake, absolutely, you know, it appears to be emerging as the norm to be able to get financial assistance from your key offtaker or offtakers for good long-term lithium offtake agreements these days, particularly somewhere like Europe, which has an enormous demand for lithium but has no production. And, you know, one of the key tenets of the CRMA, that Europe wants to have a level of self-sufficiency in lithium production coming from a zero base. So it's a strong aspiration. It's a big aspiration, and it's not easy to get there. But obviously, you know, this maybe goes to what Howard's going to talk about with regards to China. But, you know, European OEMs want product, they need lithium, and they absolutely want to source a portion of that lithium from Europe if they're able to do so. And, you know, for them to make a financial contribution to the project in order to secure that, is that's just a good business decision from their point of view.
And Keith, like all things, we've seen the cycles, specifically in a market like lithium that's quite small and niche, volatile price movements. Does that make something like a floor sale price in an offtake agreement a necessity?
We've been talking about potential floor and ceiling mechanisms with potential offtakers for a considerable period of time, like well before we saw the lithium price drop significantly late last year. So it's no surprise, and I think that is the way it will go. Obviously, the current market puts a lower floor price in the mind of the buyer, but you know that's the current market, and I think that people understand that the lithium price is going to stabilize. I think, you know, the general market suspects it's going to stabilize at a higher price than we see it today. From our point of view, it's not the floor price that's you know, particularly onerous on us. You know, our job is to get the project built, and signing an offtake agreement for the right sort of volume with a tier one European, you know, OEM and a floor price in it makes it a hell of a lot easier to go to the financiers, you know, when it comes time to be raising the capital for the project. So I have no concerns with that sort of arrangement, and giving a ceiling price as the flip side to having a floor price, that, you know, that just makes sense. You have to do it. Now, how much of your offtake you have to lock up in that sort of arrangement, we're still not 100% sure. And that, in part, is a moving number anyway, because obviously it's determined to a great degree by what that floor price is. But, you know, one of the factors about moving the processing plant is about the potential to increase production. So, you know, if we have to give up a certain portion of the slated phase one production to, you know, secure the funding, but we, you know, we have a phase two, or we have an expanded production that isn't committed, you know, we still have the potential to have the upside to a lithium price that, for lithium bulls like you and I, you know, I see the lithium price going significantly higher than where it is today.
And Keith, once the DFS is out, what are the key hurdles and milestones, like environmental and permitting, et cetera, to be cleared before getting final investment decision? What's the sort of, what is your thinking around how long that might take and what needs to be done?
So again, we have it bracketed a little now by the CRMA, and when that the clock starts ticking on the maximum, you know, the stated maximum permitting period. But we also have seen some change in legislation within country that will assist with shortening some permitting periods as well. Fundamental things like construction permits, building code, that sort of thing. Some of those things came into effect 1 January this year. We're still, you know, like I said earlier, we'll be able to talk more about what we see to be the permitting period once we get the DFS announcement then. But, you know, we are seeing positive developments at a political level and you know, that's all levels of the political scope in Czech Republic. So out of Prague, but also the region and the local government. And it, you know, there just seems to be a growing acceptance now of the industry, of where it's going, and that's helping with the conversations over permitting and therefore, you know, shortening up those timelines. The big ones are obviously the, you know, your EIA for the processing plant. The EIA for mining, we submitted the draft of that some time ago and had that accepted. We obviously have to adapt that a little. You know, you submit the mining and the processing together at the end. So the mining EIA, which has largely been accepted, will need to be adapted for that, and then move to your final mining permit and your construction permit. So they're the key ones, but, you know, around that, there's a bunch of smaller permits. You know, there's a lot of red tape. There's a lot of politics. You got to jump through these hoops. The Just Transition Fund is an evidence of that. You know, we've been in this process with the JTF for well over a year now. We expect to have the first hurdle complete this month. So that's the approval out of an EU association called JASPER, which is an acronym. And then getting through that this month pushes it up to the regional government level with a deadline of the end of next month. And then it goes to the federal ministry with a deadline at the end of the following month, which is July. So, you know, that's just an indication of the steps that you do have to take in permitting projects in Europe.
And Keith, so in terms of looking at an offtake arrangement or an OEM getting involved and so on, is there any sensitivity or indication whether there's an issue doing that prior to the release of the DFS or after, or, you know?
I think the way it will pan out, I very much would like to secure the at least our first offtake partner prior to the publication of the DFS, but some of the terms may be subject to the publication of the DFS. You know, for example, if you're looking at a financial contribution, it would make sense to know the numbers from the DFS as a part of that. But I, you know, we've seen other companies in the past sign offtake agreements, you know, at various levels, various strengths, well before getting to the stage that we're currently at. So yeah, I'd very much like to be able to talk about our key initial offtake partner prior to publicizing the DFS.
So Keith, we had a query, if you can just reconfirm the JV, when volumes are produced, how is the sale of those dealt with, particularly EMH's share? Is it sold as a geomet or as one, or do you negotiate your own transactions?
No, it's all offtake will be via geomet. It's all dealt with at a project company level.
Right. So then it's just a simple question of the mathematics. Chess gets 51, you get 49, but it's negotiated as one entity.
Yes. And this is actually, I'll point out, that's an advantage, Rodney, because European OEMs buying from a European entity it gives them a benefit.
And in terms of controlling who it is that you actually give those deals to, how does that sit with that shareholding within that entity?
So European Metals has been primarily driving the offtake discussions as part of our role in the project, but we communicate those discussions and the strategy very openly with our partner, with CHESS. We are very much on the same page as to who the offtaker, you know, first, second preference of offtakers should be. There is, you know, CHESS may well become an offtaker to this project at some time in the future through their aspirations, you know, to build a gigafactory, as we discussed earlier. They have no first right of refusal, no preferential treatment, anything like that. And that won't affect our discussions with regards to the initial offtakers.
On that, so just a reminder, so GeoMet is the operating company. You own 49% of that. They own 51%. They are obviously a large, well-capitalized company that doesn't need, you know, external financing. Although when you piece together the overall package, there'll be funding. If it's EIB or if it's just the transition fund funding, you know, that'll be at GeoMet level. So CHESS will get the benefit of that. You'll get the benefit of that. But have you appointed a financial advisor to help, you know, raise the overall package? I think you had mentioned to us that that you had.
We have Natixis, the French bank, and their Australian counterparty, Azure, who are based here in Perth. They've been working with us since last year about packaging this. We've had a number of conversations with potential participants in the financing through Azure and Natixis. And yeah, that relationship will gather momentum and, you know, towards the end of the DFS, obviously when the timing comes together.
Have they been appointed by EMH or appointed by GeoMet?
They're appointed by GeoMet. And it's an interesting mix because obviously having Natixis as a European based entity, but also having Azure, who Natixis are a shareholder in, and Azure are probably the preeminent investment bank here in Western Australia, but they are based in Western Australia, so obviously very au fait with the lithium industry because of, you know, how much lithium comes out of this part of the world now.
So just going back a little ways, CHESS came into your company, I think, in May of 2020. So during the height of COVID, you sold half the interest. They gave $32 million for half the project. And how much money is sitting still at the GeoMet level? Because you're managing, you know, the cost of EMH are not very high because you get paid from GeoMet, you know, management fees for the joint venture. But separately from that $32 million at the GeoMet level, EMH raised money in February of 2021, you know, 7 million Aussie at $1.10. And then January of 2022, you raised another $14.4 million, which was led by Euroz Hartleys. And that was a single placement to Ellerston Capital, a very large fund out of Sydney. And then you did a 6 million euro raise in July of last year with the EBRD. So adding that all up, I don't know, 30 million Aussie dollars has been raised at the EMH level. But I think your last quarterly, and we're doing this call a few days after we waited for the for the quarterly out, I think you have $5 million Aussie at the, or just correct us if I'm wrong, you know, at the EMH level. But how much money is at the GeoMet level? And you know, investors, and what's your cash burn? You know, investors, no doubt, interested how long you have.
So with the pushing out of the DFS, we're recutting the budgets on that right now, and that's some of the work that the consultants DRA and Barra are doing for us. So I don't have the formal numbers on that, but we are funded through to the conclusion at least of the DFS, even the extended DFS. What happens at Dukla will have, you know, the initial processing plant site will have an impact, obviously, because there's about 10 million euros, 10 million euros, US dollars, it's about the same, to come back to GMET out of that if we go a certain way. And we have had in our mind that between DFS and final investment decision, once we know what the timeline is and what exactly needs to be done, that we may need some money at a GMET level between now and then. We are looking to the JTF, obviously, to provide a significant amount of money, but we, you know, we don't know that until the end of July on that timeline that I gave a few minutes ago. But at this point in time, we're relaxed and I don't foresee any capital raising at EMH level until, you know, we're significantly more advanced in the project. It raises an interesting question though, Howard, because, you know, as you pointed out earlier, you know, our market cap is not what it might be. You know, there will be fundamentally options in this project as to whether money's raised at a project company level or it's raised at a European metals company level. And, you know, from our point of view, from a European metals perspective, we may be better off taking a dilution at a GMET level than at an EMH level, depending on the relative value. You know, so that's just something we have to keep a constant eye on. And, you know, work out where our shareholders are best served with regards to funding the project going forward.
Keith, that was also raised by the shareholders, I guess, is given the valuation currently, is there any sort of mechanism or some sort of defense to protect against an opportunistic run at EMH?
It's a public market. You know, anyone can buy shares in our company any day of the week. Apart from me, for example, who, you know, we're constrained by blackout periods, but I can't say who can or can't buy shares. And yeah, I'd be very disappointed if someone took over European metals and anywhere near the current market capitalization. And the only way we can perhaps prevent that from happening is to develop the project as quickly as we can, which, contrary to, you know, some of the emails I get from some shareholders, we are actually trying to do. But, you know, I have seen some of the questions that you guys are talking about, and there is also an allusion, or there's been some allusions to the mechanism for shares to perhaps buy European metals. And this is no secret. It was announced to the market when we initially announced the deal back in December of 2019. In the shareholder agreements, we have various mechanisms if there's a deadlock on opinions going forward, how we resolve those. And under one of those deadlock mechanisms, there is a way in which CHESS could acquire European metals, but it can't be enacted until at least we get the construction decision. And it would have nothing to do with the then share price or market capitalization. It's based on an independent market valuation. So that's not something that anyone needs to concern themselves about just now, because obviously we're not there yet.
In relation to this, I mean, there are two examples that come to mind. You know, Bacanora was an AIM listed company, was progressing the project for a very long time. And, you know, they received a bid, opportunistic, or they tried to piece together a funding package, but it was a challenge time, you know, and when Ganfeng, you know, came in, you know, the board, the management, you know, I think were tired of fighting the fight, and they just, you know, they gave in and they sold. You know, a number of the shareholders thought they sold too cheap, you know, but now that project, you know, the Mexican government is nationalizing it. Not suggesting that's going to happen in the Czech Republic, but, you know, is there, it's a share market. You know, if a Chinese group were to come, you deal with that when the time comes. But when I think about EMH trading, you know, this cheaply and how opportunistic a number of Chinese groups are, I can see something like that, you know, as a possibility. In the case of Lithium Power International, you know, a lot of shareholders were, you know, that was also a long time in the making, definitive feasibility study. But, you know, the government changed the rules and they orchestrated for, you know, Codelco to take that over. There was only one bidder, you know, it went for like kind of $300 million. But, you know, if somehow someone were to come with a bid for $300 million for 80 million, you know, EMH, you know, what would your shareholders say? Like, what would you say? I'm just throwing it out there. This is a hypothetical. I'm not asking you to respond directly to, you know, that specific valuation question, but I just see in both of those cases, you know, examples where, you know, those outcome great projects went, you know, maybe much cheaper than people, you know, expected, but still much higher from where, you know, the price is today. And, reading the tea leaves of like, where do you, just sitting back, you have a long history as a stockbroker, you know, before you were involved in this project, you're sitting in Western Australia, you watch, you know, Gina Reinhart's not too far from where you're sitting. You know, she is in Vulcan, and she has been very active in, Western Australia. Obviously she's comfortable with Hard Rock. I mean, this is like pocket change, you know, potentially for her to get involved there. But, you know, just looking at the landscape of players as investors, you know, from a Western Australian perspective, but also reading the tea leaves of, you know, China versus, you know, ex-China, given what I said, you know, because when I look at the company, CEZ is a utility, right? They're in, power generation, they're in gas distribution. They made an acquisition last year in the gas business, but like from a mining perspective, they've been in coal mining, right? That's about it, right? They haven't been in spodumene mining. They're not like chemical processing. And you as a company, you know, a project, you know, originator, but you're not bringing, you know, necessarily too much mining expertise or chemical expertise. So this is a hard industry. It would seem that, you know, a partner for both CEZ and you, as part of this package, well capitalized, would make sense. What are your thoughts about that? And do you think Chinese could be part of this mix?
Okay, so take that in a couple of parts. You know, it does make sense, obviously, to bring partners into a project. You know, you need various skill sets to make a project work. You know, and just for example, you know, we have spoken already to, you know, a couple of underground mining contractors about how, you know, that might work going forward. You know, bringing global underground mining expertise to the project to train up the local workforce who are largely going to have come out of open pit coal mines in the region as they're being shut down. So, you know, we're very open to this sort of development. The interesting thing is in Europe, it's, you know, there's a hell of a lot more current expertise of the processing side than there is on the mining side. And as you say, yeah, CEZ has a history of coal mining. In fact, CEZ owns its equity in Geomet through a subsidiary whose name I can never pronounce. So basically Dolly, who is a mining subsidiary. That's all they do is mining, coal mining. And, you know, there are some expertise there, but certainly not lithium mining expertise and not, you know, bulk underground mining expertise. So, you know, there will need to be bought some, you know, some partners, some expertise, some significant, you know, contracting ability to the project to get into production. On the processing side, there's at least six companies that I'm aware of at various stages of startup in Europe who have aspirations to build lithium processing facilities. That is to source feedstock in various forms, you know, lithium sulfate, you know, low grade carbon, et cetera, from other parts of the world, and turning it into battery grade chemical. So, you know, whilst that expertise isn't currently in operation in Europe, there's a lot of people with aspiration to do that. And, you know, I imagine that they'll be very successful in doing so. So there could still be a number of ways that this whole thing pans out for us. When you talk about the expertise, it's one of the reasons why we're doing the DFS initially on carbonate, despite the fact, you know, we announced a week or two ago about the very good hydroxide results that we've had. But just because, you know, carbonate is easier, cheaper, easier to handle, et cetera, and, you know, less expertise required. As we're seeing, you know, here in Western Australia, some of the difficulties, much bigger companies than we're having, and then we are having trouble producing hydroxide at anywhere near their slated production aspirations. So, you know, there's still a fair way to go with this, Howard, and still quite a few ways that it could pan out. But, you know, one of the things that I've definitely seen over the last couple of years with the project is that the attitude towards developing it within the Czech Republic and within the EU is growing significantly. It's becoming a much more can-do attitude towards this. It's still slow. You know, this is just part of the way the region operates, but the attitude towards developing this and other projects is definitely improving and improving significantly.
That's an important comment on the carbonate. And again, using that comparison to Thacker Pass, which was deciding carbonate hydroxide, you know, even though GM seems to, you know, need more hydroxide, you know, they're focused on carbonate, you know, in their initial plan. And then I guess GM will further process that carbonate, you know, elsewhere. I want to comment also, just as a reminder, you know, Umicore and BASF have announced and have implemented, I think, cathode plants in Europe. Could you comment on how the ecosystem is evolving there, and those projects? And I think LG also received EIB funding, you know, a couple of years ago. We haven't seen major announcements of EIB funding, I don't think, in a couple of years. But yeah, if you just talk a little bit about that, and then I want to ask you, and then I'll ask you another question following.
Yeah, I think the last relative EIB funding announcement of actual funding was probably Northvolt, you know, relative to what we're doing, or that's relevant to what we're doing. But we have just in the last couple of months seen both Vulcan and Euromanganese make announcements that they're in discussions with EIB. And I think that's logical. I think EIB will play a significant role in developing these sorts of projects. They have stated publicly alongside EBRD, who, as I said, you know, they're obviously a significant shareholders of ours, that they stand ready to fund the energy transition in Europe. And I think they will be there to play a significant role in that. You know, we have discussion with them, but, you know, those discussions will be formalized as we get a little bit further down the track.
So you think the EBRD, as well as the EIB, as well as the Just Transition Fund, will all be parts of your funding?
I think so, yeah. Look, I can't obviously say for sure, and you know, there are a lot of moving parts, but there's absolutely no reason why not. You know, EBRD are already a shareholder of European Metals. They in fact have a right under the deal we did with them when they became a shareholder to follow their money at a further capital raising. That's an equity capital raising at a European Metals level. But EBRD conducted something like 9 months of due diligence on us and on the project to make a 6 million euro investment. You know, I imagine that they have aspirations to play a bigger part in this overall project. And as I say, they have a very good relationship with EIB. Just Transition Fund, you know, money from the JTF doesn't preclude EIB or EBRD. In fact, it probably encourages it because, you know, they're all loosely related. CRMA talks about other potential funding opportunities without going into specifics, but, you know, there are a number of other funds in Europe that we may qualify for. We'll have to see how CRMA pans out. And then if you add on top of that, the potential for export credit finance, and then commercial debt thereafter, plus some offtake contribution, I think, you know, that however that mix comes together, that's how I think Synovix will be ultimately funded, and obviously an equity contribution.
Okay. And so the EBRD is typically a lender, not an equity investor, but they've come in at the EMH level, but that doesn't preclude them from writing a debt check, possibly alongside EIB at the Geomet level.
Absolutely. It doesn't preclude them at all.
Right. And the Just Transition Fund, that's a grant money. That's not loan, right? That's free money.
Correct.
And then in terms of offtake discussions, have you had, I mean, do you have, like a lot of spodumene developers have had processes underway led by Macquarie or others, and there are various people in data rooms and doing site visits and the like. Some are at DFS, others are not yet at DFS that we're aware of. Do you have a formal process underway, or like what's the nature of your dialogues and site visits, and without naming specific names, but are they European OEMs? Are they US OEMs? Are the Koreans, Japanese, Chinese? What's like, give us a sense of that.
Well, we actually had a German OEM that's a household name at site last Thursday, which is an interesting, you know, coincidence given you've just raised the issue. But, you know, that's a site visit, obviously doesn't necessarily mean anything. But we've had numerous OEMs at site. We are focusing on a European value chain. We have spoken with the Chinese companies. We have spoken with Korean companies. There are a number of Korean companies who are very active in the Czech Republic. There's a lot of Korean badged cars made in the Czech Republic. And there is a persistent rumor that the partner for the Czech Gigafactory will be LG, but I stress it's just a rumor, and you know we're not in any way connected with that in any event. But the intention for us, the first prize for us, is to sell our lithium to European OEMs and their European-based battery makers or cathode makers, you know, whatever. That's what we would prefer to do.
Okay. I mean, Hungary's attracted like us.
And I think that there's a very strong possibility that's where we'll end up.
Okay. Honda just came into Ontario with the assistance of, you know, significant, I think it was Ontario province support. I'm not sure if there was also federal government support in Canada for that, but you've talked a lot about EU related to this. Is there any prospective funding, you know, that could come directly from the Czech government? I know the Czech prime minister has visited the Synovex site. Is there any possibility of that? Like Czech is 70% owned by the government.
The Czech prime minister has visited the site. He's very positive about Synovex. He signed a memorandum of cooperation with the Saxony state government talking about electromobility and cross-border collaboration on lithium mining, you know, and there's not too many of us in that region, so he can only be talking about us. The Czech government is not, particularly well-funded. You know, they're not awash with cash. I would imagine that in practice, the benefits that the project is likely to receive from the Czech government would be non-cash sort of benefits, but you know that there are numerous ways that they can help financially without writing a check, no pun intended. And you know, in some regards, CHES being 70% owned by the Czech government may actually complicate that process, you know, of the Czech government making a financial contribution. I think that it's very likely that, you know, our offtake partner will come from our first offtake partner, or perhaps the key first two you know, will be companies that are domiciled in other EU member states, you know, perhaps Germany, which is obviously a very wealthy EU state with a lot of state aid programs and support with very well-developed export credit finance systems, KfWs, these sorts of people. So I think the support doesn't have to come from the Czech government from a financial point of view. I think it can be there within the EU system in a number of different places.
Well, the German Prime Minister, I think, was just in Australia saying that they need to get their lithium from Australia. I don't know if they were talking about spodumene or they're talking about hydroxide coming from those other plants, but you did mention you're now going to be Australian domiciled. I'm sure you're speaking to various people in Germany, you know, as an Australian company within a European project, right? You know, that borders their country, that you should be front, you know, of their mind. You mentioned earlier that you expect to have an offtake announcement before the DFS.
No. What I said, Howard, was I would like to.
Okay. So that's an aspiration.
You asked me if I foresaw that, and I said, well, that's my preference. That's what I would like. And you said, did I need a DFS to sign an offtake agreement? And I said, no, I don't believe I don't.
So we're going to wrap it up here, Keith. Just a reminder to all listeners, nothing that you're hearing here is financial advice, but we do have these two notes from Liberum and WH Ireland. Also, I think I have a note from Trent Barnett, who referenced you in our interview earlier this year with also a buy recommendation, you know, with target price, you know, far north from where we are from here. But if we can just, you know, stimulate hand the wallet reflex with our listeners, why buy the stock now? Like, what are the catalysts you see over the next kind of number of months that, you know, and obviously hopefully lithium price rises and that'll help, you know, lift all boats, European overall progress, you know, could help, but I don't know what to foresee there, but like company specific, there has been a bit of a lull in news flow and delay on the DFS, which has been company specific weights on the stock. What should viewers, I guess, most interestingly leave with today?
You know, when I look at it, I'd look at it from there's a macro part of this and a micro part. The macro is obviously what's happening in the region and CRMA and these sorts of things. And I've said it before, it's slow, but it's most certainly happening. You know, anyone who's watched this space for the last couple of years, as I know you guys have, you couldn't say that the groundswell is not gathering some momentum from a macro perspective. And that's the first thing. So, you know, we will see, I believe, strong support for the project from a macro EU point of view, from a macro Czech Republic point of view. And then if we go to the micro side, obviously everyone's waiting to see when we're going to say, firstly, when the DFS is going to be released, and I understand that. And then secondly, what the DFS actually says, you know, what are the numbers on this project? You know, what's CapEx? What's the OpEx? What's the IRR? Because, you know, at the end of the day, you do need to know those things. So I understand people's frustration at having it delayed. Both times it's been delayed, I believe it's been a very good reason. And, you know, I'm a significant shareholder in this company, as I remind everyone. Other micro news for us, you know, I've been banging on for a while in interviews about increasing production. It's something that I am very, very strong personally. This is me, very strong on. You know, it's a very, very big resource, fourth or fifth largest in the world of non-brine resource. But 30,000 tons per annum is a modest sort of annual production. If we can take that number, you know, if we can put a 5 in front of it, it becomes a globally significant lithium producer. And, you know, that changes things dramatically. It also means that we can secure very strong offtake agreements with the sort of people we're currently talking to, but also leave sufficient production for a Czech gigafactory which would be, you know, that would be a fantastic result. Czech Lithium and Czech cars. The Czechs are very parochial, very proud. They make a lot of cars. You know, it's 10, 11% of the GDP. And, you know, that to me would be an absolute key to seeing this project really get going.
Well, great. So that, going back to that Thacker Pass comparison, that's a 40,000 ton project with a stage two going to 80,000. And so the ability to demonstrate, you know, size, you know, is great, because just remind the total size of the Sinovec deposit.
7.6 million tons of lithium carbonate equivalent.
Wow.
The size of the deposit is important. It's not just to say that it's big, you know, it's big because it's important because it goes to long-term security of supply. It's important because the EU has stated aspirations to have by 2030, 10% of all the lithium consumed in the EU to be mined in the EU. And that looks like being about 300,000 tons of lithium carbonate equivalent. And right now, there's no way that everyone in Europe is going to be able to produce 300,000 tons of LCE by 2030. So having a big project that can produce a bigger percentage of that goal makes us more important in the eyes of Brussels.
Okay. Thank you, Keith, for this very detailed discussion. I hope shareholders and also prospective shareholders listening to this, we've witnessed on the scoreboard, you know, in any given month or 3 month period, you know, stocks can easily rise 100% or more on very little volume. And your stock is trading on very little volume. So it wouldn't really take much, even retail buying, you know, if there's confidence that you've set some milestones here in this interview, and if you meet those milestones and you get some tailwinds from the European, you know, momentum, macro momentum, and hopefully some lithium price support overall to get us back to the bullish times. Your stock was like well over $2 not that long ago, and Australian, and again, you know, your analysts covering the stock, you know, have 5, 6, 8 times NPV above where your current, you know, market cap is. So there's a lot of value potential here. You've lasted a long time. You've got capital, you've got partnered, you know, company's not going away. There's no debt on the company. So there's, you know, no risk of bankruptcy, and as a strategic project, you know, this has support. This isn't like, doesn't seem like, I haven't seen any resistance, as we saw with Jadar, you know, in Serbia, right? If anything, this is in an area, you know, where past producer, right? So it all makes sense to, you know, to happen. It just, everything takes longer than expected in lithium, and you add on Europe, and it takes even longer. So, keep the faith. I've been a shareholder. We have been a strategic advisor too, and an investor in European Metals Holdings, you know, since nearly 4 years, and all the way up, you know, and never sold a share. So all the way back down. So anyhow, we're keeping the faith, and appreciate your coming in and giving us an update.
Thanks very much for your time, Rodney and Howard. Always a pleasure chatting to you guys.